Part 6. What Could and Might Be. 21. DMT. The Spirit Molecule. It is almost inconceivable that a chemical as simple as DMT could provide access to such an amazingly varied array of experiences, from the least dramatic to the most unimaginably earth-shattering, from psychological insights to encounters with aliens, abject terror, or nearly unbearable bliss, near death, and rebirth, enlightenment. All of these from a naturally occurring chemical cousin of serotonin, a widespread and essential brain neurotransmitter. It is just as fascinating to ponder why nature or God made DMT. What is the biological or evolutionary advantage to having various plants and our bodies synthesize the spirit molecule? If DMT is indeed released at particularly stressful times in our lives, is that a coincidence, or is it intended? If it is intended, for what purpose? In the case reports, we've seen how strikingly similar volunteers' experiences are to naturally occurring psychedelic states of consciousness. It's difficult to ignore the overlap of research subjects' descriptions of high-dose DMT sessions with those from people who have undergone spontaneous, near-death, spiritual, and mystical states. While I was not expecting contact with non-material beings to be especially common before starting our work, the resemblance between those occurring in the field and in Room 531 is also undeniable. The similarities between naturally occurring and DMT-induced phenomena support my suggestion that spontaneously occurring psychedelic experiences are mediated by elevated levels of endogenous DMT. In Chapter 4, The Psychedelic Pineal, I presented a series of biological scenarios in which the pineal may synthesize DMT, and I speculated about the metaphysical and spiritual implications of these possibilities. How, then, might this spirit molecule, whether produced from the inside through these presumed biological pathways, or taken from outside, as in our studies, modify our perceptions so radically? In this chapter, we will give our imaginations free rein to consider any and all possibilities. Most of us, including the most hard-nosed neuroscientists and non-materialistic mystics, accept that the brain is a machine, the instrument of consciousness. It is a bodily organ made up of cells and tissues, proteins, fats, and carbohydrates. It processes raw sensory data delivered by the sense organs using electricity and chemicals. If we accept the receiver of reality model for brain function, let's compare it to another receiver with which we're all familiar, the television. By making the analogy of the brain to the TV, it's possible to think of how altered states of consciousness, including psychedelic ones brought about by DMT, relate to the brain as a sophisticated receiver. The simplest and most familiar levels of change to which the spirit molecule provides access are the personal and psychological. These effects may be like fine-tuning the television image, adjusting the contrast, brightness, and color scheme. These images consist of feelings, memories, and sensations that are not at all unusual or unsuspected. There is nothing especially new, but what there is now seen much more clearly and in finer detail. Low doses of DMT brought about these types of responses in our volunteers. They sometimes also occurred at higher doses, in those whose personal needs and makeup required a deeper reworking of their own lives and relationships. In performing these consciousness adjustments, DMT does not differ much from other drugs or processes used in the psychotherapeutic process. Stimulants, especially the amphetamines and amphetamine-like drugs like MDMA, enhance mental processes in a potentially helpful way. They make it easier to remember and think. By magnifying and clarifying the feelings attached to those memories and thoughts, they make it possible for us to face and accept those emotions and move on. Many of the same mechanisms apply to a deep psychotherapeutic setting. The persistence and support of the therapist in dredging up painful memories and managing the powerful emotions they evoke have similarly beneficial effects. In our DMT work, We saw drug-induced effects on the normal everyday mind combined with supportive and encouraging attitudes on our part to produce new and powerfully felt personal insights. For example, Stan could feel more acutely and directly the anxiety and stress of his divorce and its effect on his daughter. Marcia, through her dreamlike sessions in which she saw caricatures of Anglo beauty, faced the pain of her husband's difficulty accepting who she really was, physically and culturally. And Cassandra finally felt the relationship between her brutal rape and the abdominal pain she carried around with her for so many years, and thereby began to release it. There also may be biological components to some of the personal clearing, therapeutic, and healing effects we saw in these types of sessions. For example, the euphoria brought on by DMT helped volunteers more unflinchingly look at their lives and conflicts. These ecstatic feelings may be, in part, related to the powerful DMT-induced surge of the morphine-like brain chemical beta-endorphin. DMT also stimulated a massive rise in the brain hormones vasopressin and prolactin. Scientists believe these compounds are important in feelings of bonding, attachment, and comfort with other members of the species. Perhaps the elevations in these brain chemicals made it easier for our volunteers to trust us, relax into the drug effects, and share powerfully personal issues in ways that previously were impossible. What happens when the spirit molecule pulls and pushes us beyond the physical and emotional levels of awareness? We enter into invisible realms, ones we cannot normally sense and whose presence we can scarcely imagine. Even more surprising, these realms appear to be inhabited. At a certain point, I decided to accept at face value the volunteers' reports. This thought experiment replaced my original tendency to explain away, interpret, or reduce their experiences into something else, such as a disordered brain's hallucinations, dreams, or psychological symbolism. Now, after several years of additional study and reflection, I think it's worth considering seriously whether it's possible that these experiences indeed were exactly what they seemed to be. I have struggled personally and professionally with developing the following radical explanations for our volunteers' apparent contact with non-material beings. Even after stating them, I remained skeptical about their merit. Why couldn't I stick with tried and true biological or more traditional psychological models? At a brain science level, maybe what our volunteers encountered was a vivid hallucinatory experience resulting from DMT activation of brain centers responsible for vision, emotion, and thought. After all, people dream and are completely swept up in the reality of the experience at the time. The rapid eye movements that sometimes took place in our subjects may have indicated the presence of a waking dream state. However, volunteers were convinced that there were differences between what they experienced during DMT-induced contact with beings and their typical dreams. Observing the same things with eyes opened or closed, in an alert, awake state of consciousness, also made it difficult for them to accept that it was just a dream. Neither did I feel the same way, listening to their stories of encounters, as I do when one normally relates a dream to me in psychotherapy. Our volunteers' reports were so clear, convincing, and real that I repeatedly thought, "This sounds like nothing I've ever heard about in my therapy patient's dream life. It is much more bizarre, well-remembered, and internally consistent." In addition, a biological explanation along the lines of a waking dream or hallucination usually brought on a certain resistance within the volunteer. A subtle friction might develop between us that limited the depth of their sharing and disclosure that was so valuable in our work together. A research subject might say in so many words, "No, that wasn't a dream or a hallucination. It was real. I can tell the difference. And if that's what you think it is, then I'll keep the strangest aspects of my session to myself." Even more prone to cause a volunteer to dismiss my interpretations as inaccurate or inappropriate was any attempt to use psychological explanatory models. Freudian psychoanalytic systems would understand the experience of contact with beings as an expression of unconscious conflicts over aggressive, sexual, or dependency impulses. There were certainly times I used this approach in reacting to particular dreamlike sessions. However, I could not in good conscience suggest that any repressed unconscious infantile drives were behind the experimental manipulations by or communication with these beings. Jungian psychology includes a broader perspective on the language of the unconscious and builds upon and incorporates the fields of mythology, art, and religion more than the Freudian school usually does. Nevertheless, it is a psychological model, not a physical or biological one. For example, Jung referred to the image of unidentified flying objects as a yearning for wholeness, as represented by the circle. Responding to beings as mental constructs or projections, no matter how large the scale, continues to convert the experience into something else. It does not address the overwhelming and convincing sense of certainty felt by the person having the experience. Beyond these intellectual concerns, I was continually faced with the emotional challenge of the developing relationship between the volunteer's experiences and my ability to respond to them. My study, background, and experience meshed well with research subjects' descriptions of personal and transpersonal sessions such as feeling and thinking, near-death and rebirth, and mystical states. I understood these experiences. Volunteers felt I was appropriately tracking and responding to them, and there was little conflict. However, whenever I tried to react to being contact sessions with anything I knew or believed previously, it just didn't work. I was stuck. So I decided to engage in the thought experiment to which I refer at the end of chapter 13. Contact through the veil. 1. That is, I tried responding to volunteers' reports of contact with beings as if they were true. At first, this involved simply listening and asking for clarification. Later on, as more tales accumulated, I could refer to other people's accounts in an empathic manner that made it easier for volunteers to feel I understood and accepted what they had to say. That way, they could share with me their most unusual and almost embarrassingly unexpected encounters. Therefore, let's consider the proposal that when our volunteers journeyed to the further bounds of DMT's reach, when they felt as if they were somewhere else, they were indeed perceiving different levels of reality. The alternative levels are as real as this one. It's just that we cannot perceive them most of the time. In making this suggestion, I'm not discarding the brain chemistry and psychological models. Rather, I wish to add to the options we entertain in attempting to develop explanations that are helpful to volunteers, intellectually satisfying to researchers, and perhaps even testable using methods not yet invented but theoretically possible. Returning to the TV analogy, these cases suggest that, rather than merely adjusting the brightness, contrast, and color of the previous program, we have changed the channel. No longer is the show we are watching everyday reality, channel normal. DMT provides regular, repeated, and reliable access to other channels. The other planes of existence are always there. In fact, they are right here, transmitting all the time. But we cannot perceive them because we are not designed to do so. Our hard wiring keeps us tuned in to channel normal. It takes only a second or two, the few heartbeats the spirit molecule requires to make its way to the brain, to change the channel, to open our mind to these other planes of existence. How might this happen? I claim little understanding of the physics underlying theories of parallel universes and dark matter. What I do know, however, causes me to consider them as possible places where DMT might lead us, once we have rushed past the personal. Theoretical physicists propose the existence of parallel universes based upon the phenomenon of interference. One of the simplest demonstrations of interference is what happens to a light beam passing through narrow holes or slits in cardboard. Various rings and colored edges appear on the screen on which the light lands, not the simple outlines of the cardboard one would expect. Scientists conclude from this and more complex experiments that there are invisible light particles that interfere with those we can see, deflecting light in unexpected ways. Parallel universes interact with each other when interference happens. There are theoretically an inconceivably large number of parallel universes or multiverses, each similar to this one, and possessing the same laws of physics. Thus, there would not necessarily be anything especially odd or exotic about these different realms. However, what makes them parallel is that the particles composing them are located in different positions in each universe. DMT may allow our receiver brain to sense these multiverses. British scientist David Deutsch, author of The Fabric of Reality, is a leading theorist in this field. Deutsch and I have corresponded about whether DMT could modify brain function so as to provide access to or awareness of parallel universes. He doubted that this was possible because it would require quantum computing. Quantum computing, according to Deutsch, would be capable of distributing components of a complex task among vast numbers of parallel universes and then sharing the results. Thus, its potential power is unimaginably great. One of the conditions necessary for quantum computing is a temperature near absolute zero, as cold as deep space. Thus, prolonged contact between universes is unlikely in a biological system. Nevertheless, physicists once believed that superconductivity, when electricity passes through wires or other material with almost no resistance, could occur only at similarly low temperatures. Over the last 10 to 15 years, however, chemists have developed new materials that allow superconductivity at higher and higher temperatures. In fact, it is conceivable that superconductivity may one day actually occur at room temperature. I asked Deutsch if the future of quantum computing might follow a similar trajectory. While he considered this a reasonably good analogy, he held that the complexity of quantum computing was much greater than that of superconductivity. A room-temperature quantum computer would be an enormously more surprising thing than room-temperature superconductivity. Because I know so little about theoretical physics, there are fewer constraints reining me in regarding such speculations. That the analogy between superconductivity and quantum computing is reasonably good encourages me to take the next step in theorizing about DMT and the brain. In such a scenario, DMT is the key ingredient changing the brain's physical properties in such a way that quantum computing may occur at body temperature. If this were the case, seeing into parallel universes is a possible outcome. Along these lines, however, Deutsch did not think that glimpsing parallel universes would be particularly strange. He said, "Even if there were quantum computation in the brain, it would definitely not feel subjectively like seeing into quantum realms." My phrase. It would not feel special at all at the time. Just as in any other interference experiment, one would have to work backward from the logic, statistics, and complexity of the outcome of one's thoughts to infer that one must have been thinking in a quantum manner at an earlier time to achieve that outcome. Deutsch's comments about how normal a parallel universe might seem reminds me of some of the stories we did hear about in Chapter 12, Unseen Worlds. Encounters with relatively normal-appearing everyday existences that had no relationship at all to what was occurring at the research center. People, scenes, and interactions that to all intents and purposes appeared to be going on parallel to this here-and-now existence. Consider, for example, Sean's landing in the middle of a remarkably ordinary family scene in what seemed to be rural Mexico, and Heather's meeting with a Spanish-speaking woman who repeatedly threw a white blanket in front of her. Many volunteers also found themselves in empty rooms, halls, or apartments that seemed similar to this world, but also different. On the other hand, I wonder if parallel universes that formed like ours billions of years ago would appear especially familiar to us. For while the same laws of physics and therefore biology would hold sway in our world and theirs, the organisms and the technologies they developed might have taken fantastically different turns. Reptilian, insect-like, and unrecognizable shapes possessing intelligence should not be unexpected, nor should be highly advanced technology of space travel, supercomputation, and a blending of biology and technology, such as those reported by many of our volunteers. The strangest realms to which DMT might lead are those that exist within the mysterious realms of dark matter. There, which may indeed be here, no one knows what we will find. Dark matter comprises at least 95% of this universe's mass. In other words, nearly all of the matter in the universe is invisible. We cannot see it. It neither generates nor reflects radiation of any type, visible or otherwise. The only way we know it is there is by its gravitational effects. It must exist by virtue of the fact that the visible universe maintains its particular shape. Without this mass, there would not be enough gravity to hold the universe together. It would fly apart. Scientists have nominated several candidates for the stuff that comprises dark matter: normal matter that radiates little or no light, planets, dead or unborn stars, and black holes may account for about 20% of dark matter. However, it's likely that most, if not all, dark matter consists of particles quite different from our familiar protons, electrons, and neutrons. These black particles may obey entirely different laws of physics, unlike those in parallel universes. Finding ourselves in a world composed of them, we most likely would not recognize much. The leading candidates for being the building blocks of dark matter are WIMPs, or weakly interacting massive particles. They are called massive only in a relative sense, meaning they are larger than a proton or a hydrogen atom. Recent thinking about WIMPs suggests their strange nature, one that immediately causes us to hearken back to many of our volunteers' reports. If WIMPs were indeed created in the Big Bang, we will be surrounded by them because of their gravitational interaction with the visible matter in the universe. Indeed, as you read this article, there could be a billion WIMPs streaming through your body every second, traveling at 1,000,000 kilometers per hour. However, as WIMPs only interact weakly with matter, most will pass straight through you with no hindrance. Science agencies in the United States and other nations are spending billions of dollars on WIMPs sensors buried deep in the earth. They are looking for the occasional flash of light that indicates a rare collision of a dark matter particle with one of regular matter. These sensitive machines require such subterranean depths so as to block out other sources of radiation. Maybe we do not need such expensive detectors. It may be that DMT alters the characteristics of our brains so that it is possible to perceive WIMPs interacting with normal matter. It is difficult to imagine what a dark matter world might look like, let alone how its residents might appear. Maybe some of what several volunteers described as a visualization of information in Chapter 12 is a variety of dark matter life. Moving hieroglyphics pregnant with meaning, numbers and words floating by, imparting information. Either of these invisible levels of existence, parallel universes or dark matter, are present at the same time as this reality. Thus, they both are options we must consider for where DMT takes us when our consciousness is no longer in this plane of experience. The immediacy of the transition makes appealing these two alternate viewpoints regarding the incredibly unusual places our volunteers describe. This is because they are as much here as there. So the question about inside versus outside, as many volunteers posed it, really no longer has any meaning. The concept of these different levels of reality permeating and suffusing ours leads us next to the surprisingly common report by the volunteers that they were expecting me. They welcomed me back. The beings are at home working in this environment, and it's business as usual for them. We, on the other hand, can only gape slack-jawed in awe, barely able to respond. Since we usually do not see or feel these beings' presence at other times, it's worth wondering how they know when to anticipate our arrival. Perhaps before we see them, our presence is less real for these beings too. They might sense us, but not especially clearly or in a way that allows interaction with us. It is as if they see us, but only our images, as in a mirror or through a window. Thus they could be ready, but not be able to act upon us until we step through the door or walk around to their side of the window. Think of an instrument that requires an extremely hot temperature to record and send information. While at room temperature, not functioning, it is a dusty gray color and appears nearly invisible as it blends into the background. When it reaches its operating temperature, in addition to being able to perform its new receiving and transmitting functions, it now glows bright red and stands out quite clearly. Perhaps by changing our consciousness in such a way that we perceive denizens of alternate planes of existence, DMT modifies the appearance of our consciousness too. Thus we become real for the beings once they become real for us. How might these beings be even dimly aware of our presence if we normally don't have an inkling of theirs? Once more, we're treading on extraordinarily thin ice by even thinking about explanations for this phenomenon. The mere need to attempt an understanding shows us how far afield our thinking has come. Nevertheless, we can take another small step in the suspension of disbelief and consider this question. Perhaps we are not dark for the denizens of dark matter, or parallel to those intelligent beings who have mastered quantum computing. We are limited to inferring these alternative realities exist by employing powerful mathematical treatment of massive amounts of experimental data. It may be that those who have evolved in different universes or according to their own unique laws of physics actually can observe us directly with their own senses or by using particular types of technology. We must ask the next question that naturally follows. Once we are there, and the beings and we have made contact, with what body do they interact? As we have heard, all manner of manipulations took place. Adjustments, implants, pleasant and fearful sexual or physical contact. It's not an especially difficult leap to accept consciousness-to-consciousness exchanges in dark matter or parallel universes. More problematic is imagining how changes in our ability to receive new levels of reality affect our bodies. Nevertheless, I think we need to consider this, if only in a preliminary manner. While we are watching, or rather are existing in, channel normal, our body is solid, has discrete boundaries, and responds to gravity. While we are perceiving or established in channel dark matter, we may be experiencing our body using WIMPs rather than visible light and gravity. With our brain receiving such new and different levels of reality, our body also no longer appears the same. Just as the certainty of what we see, hear, and know is unquestionably true in the DMT state, so too does the nature of our physical self assume a radically different but similarly real nature. Sight and sound play such an inordinately important role in our normal awareness, and we notice our new location first with these senses. However, touch, body sensation, and matter also may assume entirely different capabilities. Using the gray and red instrument analogy above, we can just as easily substitute insubstantial for gray and palpable or solid for red. Once the dark matter beings and we are perceiving each other in the same medium, using WIMPs, they may begin to work on our dark matter bodies, adjusting Sean's ear, placing an implant under the skin of Ben's forearm, inserting a probe into Jim's eye, reprogramming Jeremiah's brain. These interventions take place using things made of dark matter or existing in parallel universes. Because of this, there is no physical evidence of these interventions back in channel normal. They don't use the material of this universe. Nevertheless, these interventions did take place. These speculations regarding unseen worlds and their residents return us to alien abduction experiences. In fact, this discussion could just as well have been about those experiences and how they happen. This striking similarity is at the basis of the hypothesis that the alien abduction experience is related to abnormally elevated levels of brain DMT. In Chapter 4, The Psychedelic Pineal, I proposed a pineal DMT link for the pivotal experiences of birth, near-death, mystical states, and death. I had little interest in or knowledge about alien encounters. The results of the DMT study challenged my ignorance and require that I now include contact as another phenomenon mediated by extraordinarily high levels of brain DMT. In his work with naturally occurring alien encounters, John Mack refers to how often these experiences occur at times of personal crisis, trauma, and loss. Perhaps in these individuals, stress and pain overcome the pineal's ability to prevent excessive DMT release and trigger access to these unusual experiences. In addition, many abductees have a history of these encounters that dates back to childhood. Such individuals may possess especially active DMT production capacities due to a biological hardwiring predisposition, possibly combined with chronic or repeated overwhelming stress. We previously discussed how some of the tendencies for excessive DMT formation might manifest using specific enzymes or enzyme inhibitors. Mack also notes that many abductions from people's homes take place in the early morning hours. The pineal gland is most active at this time. Might early morning DMT production open the portals to alien encounters in these predisposed individuals? It's fascinating to note that Mack has recently suggested that reconnection with spirituality is at the heart of the abduction phenomenon. Similarly, some of our DMT-induced being contacts, for example, those of Cassandra, Sean, and Willow, demonstrated a transition from surprise and shock at the presence of intelligent beings to a greater depth of spiritual and psychological equilibrium. These mystical experiences are the last set of encounters to which the spirit molecule may lead. They were the ultimate goals of many volunteers who participated in our research. Why, then, did so many of our research subjects instead find themselves in unexpected, unseen worlds? It may be that the raw, unbridled power of DMT caused our research subjects to overshoot or miss their target. It reminds me of the first time we get in the saddle of a powerful motorcycle. The thrust is so unimaginably forceful that we often fly off the back of the vehicle or head straight into a ditch. Only by learning how to deal with its strength can we harness the machine and go straight ahead to our goal. In a similar vein, I believe research subjects with primarily contact experiences would have gone beyond that level and reached the transpersonal if given adequate time and practice. Sean's and Cassandra's cases support this theory. They moved on from contact with beings to mystical and healing experiences with repeated exposure to high doses of DMT in the tolerance study. Another explanation is less sanguine. That is, high doses of IV DMT thrust people into being-inhabited planes of reality, because that is what it does. Give enough DMT to people, and this is what happens. I'm reminded of Jeremiah in Chapter 13, Contact Through the Veil, 1, when he was swept into the alien laboratory nursery. He attempted to steer the sheer intensity of the experience into a spiritual encounter by opening to love. However, he immediately realized it was impossible to do so. Maybe contact through the veil is the real ultimate function of DMT, rather than initiating mystical awareness. If the sheer numbers of volunteers' reports are any indication of the truth of this suggestion, we must consider it likely. In the case of near-death and mystical states, let's consider the DMT does more than just change channels, providing us with a view of another channel's program. I suggest this because of the empty or contentless nature of the peak mystical experience. There is no sound, touch, vision, smell, or taste, no thoughts or words, and no time. Simultaneously, there is an indescribable completeness, power, and understanding. In between TV channels is snow, the white noise and images associated with what is between the various stations' programming material. What is there if we look and listen carefully? It is the very nature of the activated television itself, electricity coursing through it, energizing and driving it to display something. But that something seemed like nothing to the pattern-seeking everyday mind. In this case, the best analogy might be that DMT has reconfigured the brain's receptive qualities to now stop receiving outside information. It is only aware of its own existence, its own intrinsic nature. It displays its own consciousness or resonating frequencies, which have no particular content. Nevertheless, it is the ground upon which all of the programs depend for support, the space that the channels fill. The space between channels, or the absence of channels, is not empty. Rather, it is itself full. The content of the programs replaces this perfect emptiness with their busy fullness. Neither is its nature necessarily potential. Rather, it is complete unto itself. It needs nothing to exist as it is, but it needs something in order to take shape or form to manifest. For some volunteers, DMT's ripping away of consciousness from the body was the stimulus to seek that space between the various levels of perceived reality. They went straight to that empty totality underlying their sense of themselves and the outside world, no longer supported by the body. As Freud commented years ago, the ego is first and foremost a body ego. With no body, what's left? These research subjects, like Carlos and Willow, experienced mystical consciousness by virtue of leaving their bodies behind. Other volunteers found their way to their essential nature through a more direct use of their own will. Sean gave himself permission to go further and deeper into the unknown. Elena disengaged from the wild display of psychedelic colors that obscured their formless foundation. Both succeeded in pulling back and moving forward with just the exquisite knife-edge balance required to make that daring leap into the space between thought, perception, and feeling. The spirit molecule led them to the edge, but it was up to them to take the final step. Now that we've covered some of the ways in which naturally occurring or outside-administered DMT may provide us with access to such remarkable and astonishing experiences, let's consider the evolutionary significance of naturally produced DMT. In other words, why is there DMT in all of our bodies? Is it a coincidence? Or is it for a purpose? From the perspective of plants, mushrooms, and animals that contain DMT, it is reasonable to propose that other species, especially humans, would seek and protect them. Those who smoke, drink, or eat DMT-rich life forms experience highly desirable transport to worlds beyond the imagination. Those psychedelic experience-inducing species would rank high on a list of essential renewable resources, and their survival becomes important to their neighbors. But then why do humans produce DMT? To date, we have discovered no life form that smokes, eats, or drinks human pineal glands, so we must discard the hypothesis that DMT somehow ensured our physical survival. Perhaps our ancient ancestors who produced DMT possessed some adaptive advantage over those who did not. Maybe their access to different states of consciousness provided superior problem-solving abilities compared to DMT-less members of our species. Those who had the capacity to synthesize DMT eventually replaced those who did not. While there is some appeal to this argument, the presence of DMT in so many other readily available forms weakens it to some extent. That is, if someone could not make their own DMT by, for example, deep meditation, there are plenty of plants full of DMT much easier to use than austere spiritual practices. This would certainly be the case for people who live in a DMT-rich environment, such as Latin America. A more fruitful line of reasoning emerges from the implications of DMT release at death and near-death conditions. These are the times in which the life force or spirit moves into, out of, and through our bodies. We discussed the biological mechanisms of this proposal in Chapter 4. Here, let's use those ideas to investigate their possible significance. At first glance, there seems little evolutionary advantage to the individual or the species in releasing enlightening chemicals as we die. However, Carl Jansen, a British psychiatrist, proposes that one particular type of near-death brain chemical does indeed confer benefit to the nearly dead. This is because of their neuroprotective properties. In the presence of ketamine, strokes and other acute forms of brain injury are less destructive. Animal data suggests that ketamine-like substances exist in the brain. Thus, during near-death experiences, the brain may release these substances in order to minimize brain damage in case that individual survives. The nature of the near-death experience is due to the psychedelic side effects of ketamine. However, there remains the question of why ketamine has psychedelic rather than, say, tranquilizing effects. While the release of neuroprotective compounds near death certainly is a useful response, the psychedelic side effects are not as obviously beneficial. We must therefore wonder, are these spiritual properties a coincidence, or do they have a purpose? I suggest that near-death chemicals released by the brain are psychedelic for this reason. They must be. It is similar to asking why there is silicon in computer chips. Silicon works. It does the job. Near-death brain products are psychedelic because those are the properties consciousness requires at that time. Psychedelic compounds released near death mediate consciousness exiting the body. This is their function, and this is what they do. DMT is a spirit molecule, just as silicon is a chip molecule. Rather than just causing the mind to feel as if it were leaving the body, DMT release is the means by which the mind senses the departure of the life force from it, the content of consciousness as it leaves the body. These theories refer solely to DMT's role in unusual states of consciousness. However, might DMT exert an effect on our normal everyday awareness? The fact that the brain actively transports the spirit molecule across the blood-brain barrier suggests this might be the case. In Chapter 2, What DMT Is, I pointed out that the brain seems to hunger for DMT. It expends precious energy actively transporting the drug from the blood into its inner recesses. It is as if DMT were necessary for normal brain function. Perhaps just the right amount of DMT is involved in the brain's maintenance of the correct receiving properties. That is, it keeps our brains tuned in to channel normal. Too much, and all manner of unusual and unexpected programs appear on the mind's screen. Too little, and our view of the world dims and flattens. In fact, these types of numbing, vitality-draining effects are what normal volunteers describe when they take antipsychotic drugs. These drugs may block the effects of endogenous DMT. Perhaps we see and feel what we do on this level of existence because of just the right amount of endogenous DMT. It is an essential component maintaining our brain's awareness of everyday reality. In a way, we might consider DMT to be a reality thermostat, keeping us in a narrow band of awareness so as to ensure our survival. When all the speculation, no matter how exciting, stimulating, and revolutionary, is over and done, what are we left with? Even if it turns out that what I've proposed is one day proven true, what do we truly gain from DMT? Once more, we return to, if so, so what? To what purpose? As the New Mexico research drew to its complicated ending, I began to work through the deepest question that I brought to the studies. In the beginning of this chapter, I raised the issue of how difficult it is to accept the existence and effects of the spirit molecule in our bodies. In a similar way, can we accept the conclusion I have finally reached, that is, that the nature of DMT is essentially neutral and value-free? The spirit molecule is neither good nor bad, beneficial nor harmful, in and of itself. Rather, set and setting establish the context and the quality of the experiences to which DMT leads us. Who we are and what we bring to the sessions and to our lives ultimately mean more than the drug experience itself. Nevertheless, DMT and other psychedelics will never disappear, especially those we make in our own brains every minute of the day. We must take into account all of their complex and mysterious power in any reckoning of human consciousness. So this one neither-nor answer does not mean that there aren't many unqualified yeses to important questions about the best use of these drugs. The set and setting we used in New Mexico provided a tremendous amount of information about what is and isn't possible with the assistance of the spirit molecule. Now it is time to turn to what to do with that knowledge. Is it possible to convert that information to good use?